From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caritti, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, October 18th, 2016. And on this day, Governor Paul LePage says Maine's media complied with welfare fraud when they didn't immediately report a case involving allegations of welfare and other fraud at a Halal grocery in Portland. Maine voters are requesting more absentee ballots than ever before, and more requests are coming from Democrats than Republicans. And a preview of tonight's Maine Public Television debate between 2nd District candidates Emily Kane and Bruce Poliquin. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
I'm Barbara Caritti. Governor Paul LePage says Maine's media is complicit in welfare fraud because they didn't immediately report on a publicly available federal affidavit that details allegations of welfare and other fraud at a Halal grocery in Portland. The case blew into the general public yesterday when a conservative website first reported it. As Fred Bever reports, the situation illustrates the different ways media outlets, including Maine Public Radio, decide to balance the general public interest against an individual's right to due process.
In an affidavit for a search warrant that was unsealed by the U.S. District Court in the spring, an FBI agent described a joint undercover investigation deployed by the FBI, the IRS, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He said there was probable cause to believe that food stamp fraud, tax fraud, wire fraud, and money laundering took place in a scheme that cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars and maybe millions. A judge approved the search warrant, and federal agents raided the Ahram grocery. Charges still have not been filed, but Monday afternoon, Governor LePage for the first time drew public attention to the affidavit following a report by an online media outlet called LifeZet, helmed by conservative talk show host Laura Ingraham. In a subsequent press release, LePage charged local Maine media with, quote, hiding welfare fraud. He repeated the assertion in a Tuesday appearance on WVOM radio.
We've known about it for a while. We've been trying to work with Maine media, you know, the journalists in Maine to try to get it out to the people, but they just refused to do it. In fact, Rick, if I didn't know better, I'd say they're complicit in this fraud.
LePage also says he hopes that the subjects of the investigation will be deported. His open commentary seemed to mark a shift in the administration's willingness to go public with the case. Maine Public Radio retrieved the FBI affidavit from Portland's Federal District Court in August. At the time, Justice Department officials declined comment. After, Maine Public Radio contacted LePage's Commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services, Mary Mayhew, about the allegations. She declined to comment on the affidavit or the store or individuals in question, citing what appeared to be an open federal investigation. She did say that the state was on the lookout for patterns of fraud in the food stamp program.
There are cases that have come to light in other states where there have been prosecutions that clearly demonstrate the kind of criminal activity that does occur among retailers. And certainly we have serious concerns about that level of activity occurring in the state of Maine.
Maine Public Radio decided to hold the story until federal charges were filed, an arrest was made, or other developments. Kelly McBride, a media ethicist at the Poynter Institute, says there are no set rules about when journalists should or should not publicize an unsealed affidavit. She says news organizations should weigh a subject's rights to due process and whether that is outweighed by the public good that publication would provide.
And a lot of journalism organizations that would feel very comfortable reporting on an affidavit, if they had the resources to do reporting like a parallel investigation, so that they could reassure themselves that this isn't, that this has some merit.
Keith Shortall, Maine Public's Director of News and Public Affairs, says that as a rule, the news outlet tries to show deference to the right to due process. It will not report on criminal allegations that have not resulted in charges or indictment.
There are exceptions to that. One might be the public's right to know. For example, if there's a public figure involved directly. We might also report further on it if we were able to verify ourselves some of the information that was in the affidavit.
Shortall says Maine Public Radio did not have the resources to mount an independent investigation, thus the decision to wait for charges or other developments. It's not clear whether other news organizations had the affidavit before LifeSet and LePage publicized it. The Bangor Daily News declined comment, although the newspaper's Statehouse reporter wrote that no one had ever, quote, approached the Bangor Daily News about the story. Portland Press Herald managing editor Steve Greenlee says it was not aware of the affidavit before the LifeSet story, but it judged that the scale of the alleged fraud in its hometown and being publicized by the governor to be newsworthy. And within hours, the newspaper did publish an online account of the affidavit.
It was already out there. Some websites had reported this already. We did go down to the gentleman's store and asked him if he was aware of the investigation. He confirmed he was aware of the investigation. He didn't want to talk in detail about it, but he did tell us he was aware of it.
Greenlee adds that the organization has in the past reported on affidavits that haven't yet resulted in charges. Maine Public Radio's Keith Shortall says it is doing so now as well, given that the names of the alleged perpetrators are now widely available in the Maine media and beyond. The allegations in the request for a search warrant were levied against Ashraf Eldeknawe and Ali Taham. The affidavit by FBI agent James Chapman claims that there was probable cause to believe they participated in various frauds centered at the Aram Market in Portland. In a statement, a lawyer for Taham, Walter McKee, says his client is adamant that he has done nothing wrong and is looking forward to a full airing of the case. A lawyer for Eldeknawe, Leonard Sharon, says he would have no comment. For purposes of disclosure, Leonard Sharon is married to Maine Public Radio's deputy news director, Susan Sharon. She recused herself from any discussions and decision-making related to the affidavit. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Fred Bever.
And in a statement emailed to Maine Public Radio, lawyer Leonard Sharon questions the motivations behind the disclosure of the affidavit. He suggests the constitutional rights of both men were being ignored for political gain. And he says they, quote, thought they had left that brand of justice in Iraq and Egypt, where trials are often political sideshows, where guilt is presumed. Meanwhile, Republican Governor Paul LePage says he doesn't think Maine is going to have a clean election because IDs aren't required to vote. LePage told WVOM-FM on Tuesday that, quote, people from the cemetery will be voting and that people who aren't citizens will be voting as well. He said that until identification is required at polling places, that elections in Maine and the U.S. won't be, in his word, legitimate. Secretary of State Matthew Dunlap, Maine's top election official, disputed the governor's contention about voter fraud and called voter identification a political issue. LePage's comments echo Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's comments. Trump has said that the election is, quote, rigged. Meanwhile, it's that time of year when Maine voters who serve in the military, who are living overseas, or who just want the convenience of voting early can request an absentee ballot. This year, requests for absentee ballots are on pace to top the number in the presidential contest 4 years ago. And as Mal Leary reports, more Democrats are requesting them than Republicans.
In 2012, nearly 188,000 absentee ballots were cast. But election officials say this year, the number could be even higher than that. They also say Democrats are doing a good job of getting their party members to request them. In 2012, Democrats requested just over 40% of the mailed ballots compared to 25% for Republicans. So far this year, Democrats have requested 51% of the mailed ballots compared to about 22% for Republicans. Jim Melcher, a political science professor at the University of Maine at Farmington, says that's good news for Democrats.
Democrats have always put more emphasis upon early voting as part of their electoral strategy, but the fact that they're ahead of where they've been in previous years certainly is a sign of enthusiasm among Democrats.
But Melcher says more requests for ballots by Democrats does not necessarily mean more political victories for Democrats. Mainers are well known for voting for the candidate, not necessarily the party. Republicans are also requesting ballots at a higher level than 4 years ago. University of New England political science professor Brian Duff says while the increase in requests is good news for Democrats, this election has already proved to be far from predictable.
I mean, the profoundly unpredictable thing about this election is that Trump's campaign depends so much on this group of white voters, especially white men who do not have college degrees.
A group that does not normally vote in high numbers. So can that group of voters be targeted to request absentee ballots or vote at the polls next month? Absolutely, says social science professor James Cook at the University of Maine at Augusta. He studies the interaction of social media and politics.
Research has been funded by our own government has been able to figure out pretty well who you're friends with, even if you don't share that information online. So predictive modeling has escalated to really quite impressive and perhaps alarming levels.
With the tight race for president, Maine's heated contest in the 2nd Congressional District, and several controversial referenda on the ballot, Secretary of State Matt Dunlap is expecting a record number of absentee ballots this year and a total vote that could set a record.
Overall turnout of our vote, we could see over 35% of our overall turnout will be by absentee this year.
That's around 270,000 voters. Maine always is among the top two or three states for voter participation. And with the confluence of candidate races and ballot issues this year, Dunlap says the state could see 900,000 Mainers cast ballots. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Coming up, Maine's 2nd Congressional District candidates Bruce Poliquin and Emily Kane square off tonight in a debate on Maine Public Television. And critics are wary of a plan to expand a landfill near Old Town. Travel writer and public television host Rick Steves has been in Maine the last couple of days to lend his support to the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol. Steves has donated $100,000 to the campaign in an effort to pass Question 1 on the November ballot. He says he sees Question 1 as a common sense way to legalize, tax, and regulate a relatively benign drug, despite the concerns raised by the opposition.
Here in Maine, it just seems like the political establishment is talking like it's 2010. And in 2010, I could understand politicians being nervous about this. But this is 2016 now. We have a track record. We know in Colorado and Washington, it's been 4 years since we legalized and taxed and regulated marijuana. Use has not gone up. Teen use has not gone up. Crime has not gone up. And DUIs have not gone up. What has gone up is tax revenue.
In his home state of Washington, Steve says the government is enjoying $120 million worth of tax revenue that's not coming out of people's pockets, but instead out of a once-thriving black market that has been turned on its head. A member of the Advisory Board of Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, Steves describes himself as a recreational pot smoker who came to favor the lifting of prohibition after spending time in Europe. Steve says he doesn't want to see the equivalent of big tobacco take over the retail marijuana market, which is why he says he likes Question 1's limits on licensing. As for the Maine Attorney General's finding that the measure contains a loophole that could make it legal for minors to use pot without penalty, Steve says there's a simple solution.
Nobody wants people under 21 to have marijuana, and right off the bat in the legislature, Maine would fix that provision and make it really explicit and clear that this is for mature adult use, people over 21, and the restrictions and the safeguards to keep marijuana away from kids are very strong and very smart.
Five states are considering marijuana measures this fall, including Maine and Massachusetts, where Steves heads next. He has also pledged $100,000 toward passage of that measure. Meanwhile, elected officials from Portland, Lewiston, Westbrook, and North Berwick held a press conference today in support of ballot question 2. That's the measure that would add a 3% tax surcharge on incomes higher than $200,000 a year to help fund public K-12 education. Among the supporters is Portland Mayor Ethan Strimling.
People want to invest money in education, but the problem is, where do you get it? And this referendum makes very clear that the people of this state are saying, you know what, let's get it from the people who can afford it most, put it into the schools that need it most, and make sure that our property taxpayers are not overburdened.
Supporters of Question 2 say it would raise as much as $157 million a year for public schools, ease property taxes in the state, and help prepare Maine kids to be productive members of the workforce. But opponents say it wouldn't treat some towns fairly, that it would hurt small businesses, and that it could drive people and businesses out of Maine. And as part of our Your Vote 2016 campaign coverage, Maine Public Television will broadcast the 2nd District Congressional Debate, where Republican incumbent Bruce Poliquin is facing Democratic challenger Emily Kane. Poliquin first won his seat in the U.S. House of Representatives 2 years ago after serving as state treasurer. Emily Kane is a former state senator. In this excerpt from the hour-long debate, Maine Public's Jennifer Rooks asked the candidates about an issue important to their constituents.
Maine's 2nd District has seen hundreds of jobs lost due to the closure of mills. What is your plan, Emily Kane, and I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to answer, to help the towns and communities devastated by these job losses? Bruce Poliquin, I'll give you about 2 minutes after that, and then we'll be out of time. Go ahead, Emily.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. There are no working mills now on the Penobscot River. The people who worked in the Lincoln Mill and the Old Town Mill are my friends. My friend Roger worked at the Lincoln Mill for decades. He had to make the tough decision after he lost his job to either stay here and try to cobble it together or take a job out of state. It was a terrible decision for him. He wants to come back and work at home. It makes me think of a guy I met in Farmington who's a sheet metal worker who goes to work every week on Monday morning but hasn't worked in Maine in 4 years. He works out of state, where they're building things, where he can fix things. My dad used to leave every week for work. He used to leave, pack his bags on Sunday night, his cases of shoes, and leave Monday morning. I'm thinking about people like my dad, who've worked harder than ever to just try to do right by their families and bring those good jobs back. My focus in Congress will be to grow our economy by investing in ourselves and our natural resources. Of course, the biggest one of those is our hardworking people, the people I meet every day who are working harder than ever and just want to make ends meet. I'm going to be focusing on forestry and biomass, on farming and agriculture, fishing and aquaculture, on manufacturing, that we can make things here in Maine that they're going to want all over the world. And we do that by connecting the dots, focusing on transportation, focusing on internet access and cell phone service. When you're trying to run a small business, if you can't connect or if your cell phone service drops between Millinocket and East Millinocket, you're in trouble. My definition of success for our economy is an economy built on small businesses owned by Mainers, so that we can be in charge of our destiny when it comes to our economy. I have a record of doing that by lowering taxes, supporting economic development in rural Maine, and working across the aisle to make tough decisions. I'm ready to go to Congress to work for you, not for Wall Street. Ready to go to Congress to work for growing our economy, not growing more jobs someplace else. I'm going to stand up to bad trade deals that send our jobs overseas, and Maine people can count on me to be trusted with bringing those good jobs home.
All right, Bruce Poliquin, Maine 2nd District has seen hundreds of jobs lost to the closure of mills. What is your plan to help the towns and communities devastated by these job losses?
There are five things we have to do, Jennifer, to make sure we bring these high-paying career jobs back to Maine. First of all, we need business skills down in Washington, not career politicians who have no experience creating jobs. That's number one. Second of all, we need to make sure we lower the cost of energy. We need to this new carbon tax that Emily is supporting is absolutely the wrong way to go. It'll drive up the cost of electricity and kill more of our manufacturing jobs. We need to have lower energy costs. We also need to make sure regulations are fair and predictable. At Sappy Paper, 850 jobs. I helped them to make sure that the biomass regulations were not so onerous and punitive that it would cost them so much money that it would jeopardize the future investment of that mill. And we need to make sure that taxes are lower. If you talk to all the folks that run these mills, it is high cost of energy, it is taxes, it is regulations, and it also, by the way, is unfair trade. And that's why I've always stood up to make sure trade is fair. When I was a kid growing up in Oakland and Waterville, my grandmother worked at Hathaway Shirt Company. My best buddy across the street, Stevie Campbell, his dad was a machinist at Scott Paper Company. I worked the night shift at the Wyandotte Mill in Sydney. My brother worked at the Cascade Woolen Mill in Oakland. We've seen all of these mills go under. And the reason is because of this drip, drip, drip in Maine. High energy costs, high taxes, punitive regulations, and trade deals that aren't fair. I have the way, the knowledge, and the experience to deal with those. Emily Kane does not.
And you can watch the entire debate on Maine Public Television beginning tonight at 9 o'clock. We'll rebroadcast it several times on both TV and radio. You can find out when on our website, mainepublic.org. And it's taken more than 4 years, but Casella Waste Systems and the state moved closer today to getting a decision on Casella's plans to expand the Juniper Ridge landfill near Old Town. During the first of 2 days of public hearings in Bangor before the Maine Board of Environmental Protection, Casella's engineering team provided extensive studies in support of the project. But as A.J. Higgins reports, critics remain wary.
For 13 years, Casella has operated the state-owned Juniper Ridge landfill in Alton, a disposal site for residues from the state's waste-to-energy facilities and other refuse. It's a large landfill, but one that is running out of room. So the company and the state want the Board of Environmental Protection to approve an expansion plan that would increase the facility's capacity from 10 million cubic yards to nearly double that amount. The expansion would extend the landfill's operational capacity by nearly 10 years to around 2027 or longer, depending on increased recycling efforts.
We are by far the largest recycler in the state of Maine.
Tony King, a regional engineer for Casella, says her company's recycling policies will ensure that additional capacity will be utilized judiciously through efficient recycling programs.
Simply put, the waste disposed at Juniper Ridge Landfill is reduced to the maximum extent practicable, diverted where appropriate, and 90% has already been processed or is a recycling residual for which a landfill is the most appropriate end-of-life solution.
Casella engineers provided board members with an extensive analysis that they say supports their position that the geological characteristics of the region and the technology being used would provide a safe waste containment area for decades to come. John Seavey, a regional engineer for Casella, said the area's soil composition would be able to support the added waste capacity at the landfill.
The clay nature of the till gives it its relatively low permeability. That low permeability is a desirable characteristic because by having something that has a lower permeability, if there were to be a leak or a spill of leachate at the site, you want a soil that retards the movement of that so you can get in there and clean it up.
But opponents of the plan are not necessarily swayed by the science, and those abutting the property want assurances that landfill leakage will never contaminate the groundwater in the region. Others, such as Dana Snowman, an intervener in the Casella application, question the company's claims that none of the waste that's being buried in his town comes from out of state.
There's been, I believe, a concerted effort to hide the amount of garbage that originated out of state going into that dump, and I just would like to, I'd just like to have them admit it. If the general public wants a dump that's half full out of state garbage, then that's fine with me.
Other Alton landowners, such as Larry Beauregard of Brewer, say that while they would prefer not to have a larger landfill in town, the engineering studies at least offer some reassurance. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
And herring fishermen are nearing their quota along New England's coast, and the fishery will be shut down until further notice. The National Marine Fisheries Service says fishermen in the inshore Gulf of Maine have caught about 90% of their quota, and the fishery was shut down early this morning. The inshore fishing zone ranges from Cape Cod to the eastern edge of the Maine coast. Herring are an important bait fish, especially in the lobster fishery. A shortage of the fish in offshore waters caused a bait shortage in New England during the summer. The fish are also used as food. Fishermen typically catch between 175 million and 200 million pounds of Atlantic herring every year. And the University of Maine is creating the Stephen E. King Chair in Literature in honor of one of its most famous graduates. The appointment is set to begin in August. The university says the position is tenured and designed to honor the UMaine English Department's most celebrated graduate. King graduated from the university in 1970 with a degree in English. His first novel, Carrie, was published 4 years later, and he's been one of America's most beloved horror and fantasy authors for four decades. The position is partially endowed by the Harold Alfond Foundation. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
A warm front will continue to slowly edge north overnight, temperatures steady if not rising, through the 50s, punching above 60 degrees prior to dawn, Portland south. There'll be a few misty moments over the coastal plain and isolated showers inland, the focus over the mountains. Tomorrow, expect short-sleeve midsummer weather for most. Delightful once the morning clouds crumble away. Mostly sunny. Temperatures not too far from record highs. Low 60s far north to the upper 70s deep south. Atlantic, tropical, and Pacific moisture will join forces Thursday. Following morning sunshine, clouds will overwhelm Maine, with showers reaching the mountains only late in the day. Mid-50s north, low 60s south. Low pressure will swirl into New England Friday. Not exactly a drought buster, yet periods of badly needed rain will predominate, cloaked in fog. Heaviest rain north, 50s to 60 statewide. Saturday will be the last mild day. Breezy, again 50s to near 60. Lingering showers across the mountains in northern Maine. Slivers of sunshine for the rest of the state. Brightest along the entire coastal plain. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
That's the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, October 18, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Fred Bever, Mal Leary, A.J. Higgins, Patty White, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.